to Pluto and beyond. Checking in with Alan Stern of the New Horizons mission this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. We welcome back one of our most frequent guests as the New Horizons principal investigator helps us celebrate the 5th anniversary of his spacecraft's Pluto encounter. Wait till you hear what it has been up to since. Alan will also share plans to ride along as Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin carry science to the edge of space. Have you seen the comet? Bruce Betts will tell you how when we reach for the sky in this week's What's Up segment. Ever been in a dust storm? I have, but it wasn't on Mars. The European Space Agency's Mars Express orbiter captured a truly jaw-dropping image of a line of dust clouds rolling across the red planet's surface. That's the first thing you'll see in the July 3rd edition of the Downlink at planetary.org/downlink. Then there are the headlines collected by our editorial director, Jason Davis, including the delay in the launch date for Perseverance. NASA's Mars 2020 rover will now lift off no sooner than the 30th of July. It's the upper stage of the Atlas V rocket that is causing worries, not the rover. NASA is joining with the Royal Australian Air Force and the newly created U.S. Space Force to find and track potentially dangerous NEOs, or near-Earth objects. They'll use a telescope that is being moved from the U.S. to down under for this work. NASA also blew up its giant Space Launch System rocket. Don't worry, they did it on purpose by filling the liquid oxygen tank with water and subjecting it to far more pressure than is ever expected on a mission. You can check out the visit some of my colleagues made to the SLS test stand back in 2016. This link and so many others are at planetary.org/downlink. We'll mail it to you every week for free, if you'd like. July 14th, 2015. I didn't get to join Alan Stern and his team at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab for the climax of the New Horizons mission. We now know that the Pluto encounter was only the first climax for this spacecraft that left Earth in the first days of 2006. It went on from revealing the beauty of Pluto to an oddly shaped object called Arrokoth, and now is doing groundbreaking science as it plunges toward the edge of our solar neighborhood. It is even reaching out to nearby stars. Alan has more credits and accomplishments than we have time to read, but they include his service as NASA's Associate Administrator in charge of science. He has a hand in many projects and missions and is Associate Vice President and Special Assistant to the President at the Southwest Research Institute. He joined me a few days ago from his home in Colorado to celebrate the 5th anniversary of the Pluto flyby and much more. Alan, welcome back to Planetary Radio. You have been on as much as just about anybody, and it is always a great pleasure and an honor.
Well, Matt, thanks for having me back. It's an honor at my end, too.
I'm glad to hear that. This interview is going to be made available to our listeners very, very close to the 5th anniversary of that glorious day when your spacecraft had its thrilling closest encounter with Pluto. And now it's been just, what, about a year and a half since its second big triumph, the flyby of what we now call Arrokoth. 14 and a half years in space, and you're still not done. Where is New Horizons now, and what shape is it in?
Well, New Horizons is one amazing bird. It's really a testament, I think, to American workmanship. New Horizons is now, if you can believe it, more than 5 astronomical units, that being the distance from the Earth to the Sun, 5 times that far from Arrokoth already. We're over 2 billion miles past Pluto. We are 47 times as far from the Sun as the Earth is. Next year, in early 21, we will cross the 50 AU marker, astronomical unit marker. And I think we're going to have some sort of a celebration. Not many spacecraft have been this way before.
No, what? You'll be what, number 5, I think?
Number 5 or number 10, depending if you count the derelict upper stages for each of the 5.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, well, the ones that actually talked to us for a good part of that mission.
Right. Well, You know, the spacecraft is in perfect health. We're not using any of the backup systems because of failures. And we've got fuel to run this thing and power to run it, possibly for as much as 20 more years. So I'm excited about the science that's still ahead.
Let's start working our way out of the solar system. You mentioned that 2007 Jupiter flyby, and you picked up science there too, of course. But if you don't mind, let's head straight out for Pluto, because the science keeps rolling in. I mean, what's the latest news and science from that gorgeous world and its nearby neighbors?
Pluto is gorgeous in so many ways, from being the little planet with a heart on it, just to the amazing variety of geology and its beautiful blue atmosphere and hazy skies, and its satellite system as well. At the time of the flyby, I think I famously said that I thought the solar system had saved the best for last. And I haven't changed my mind. Pluto continues to astound us. You know, it took almost a year and a half just to get all the data back. I often felt like we were docs in an emergency room, just triaging patients and stabilizing it, except our patients were the data sets. We made hundreds of different kinds of observations of Pluto and its five moons, color imagery, black and white maps, composition maps, atmospheric spectra, plasma data from two different plasma spectrometers, radio science. And as I said, there were hundreds of observations. At first, we were just skimming the cream off the top. What do we see? Let's report it. But as time went on and we got all the data on the ground and we got through the first review of all the data, there was time for more considered thinking, for computer modeling of the geology, the geophysics, the geochemistry, the atmosphere. And then there were new discoveries by looking harder at the data or by integrating different data sets together to see how they told or supported a story. Pluto just continues to get more and more complicated. For a small world, it really is almost off the scale in terms of the geologic complexity and diversity that we see. But there are a couple of themes, to answer your question, that have kept coming up over the last few years. One is we see more and more lines of evidence that point to Pluto being an ocean world, having liquid water ocean in its interior. In fact, there's even evidence now by NASA researcher and New Horizons co-investigator Dale Cruikshank up at NASA Ames Research Center that this water from the interior has flooded out onto the surface in some places, and it carries with it organics.
Wow.
So this is really interesting. The story is getting much more nuanced and much more interesting from an astrobiological standpoint. The other thing that we see more and more lines of evidence for is cryovolcanism, a variety of different styles of features that look related to cryovolcanism across the flyby hemisphere. I think that's an interesting story too. And all of those features turn out to be devoid of craters on their surfaces, meaning that they're young, that cryovolcanism may have been in Pluto's recent past.
Let's go another step out into the solar system, 3.5 years beyond your encounter with Pluto, to that New Year's celebration that I was able to join you for at APL, the Applied Physics Lab there in Maryland, and the flyby of Arrokoth. What we now know as Arrokoth anyway, the science is still coming from that as well. I mean, have you now, about a year and a half after the encounter, has all of that data been received?
Well, actually, not quite. We've got all the pixels from all the instruments that were on Arrokoth, the Kuiper Belt object. But the surrounding pixels that we use for background subtraction, those on the black sky, and for satellite searches as well and ring searches, are still coming to the ground. So it's going to be a while before we get all of that, but you won't see new pictures of Arrokoth itself or any new spectra because those are safely back on Earth.
But the science is still rolling out. I mean, you and your team had a big announcement in February of this year. Tell us about this work that may have helped solve apparently one of the oldest mysteries about the formation of objects like Arrokoth.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had three papers published together in Science in February in a single issue that took a hard look at everything that we learned from that flyby, from composition to geology to origins. And as you were saying, Aircoth has been a tremendous gift to planetary science. We couldn't have asked for anything more in a small Kuiper Belt object, and none had ever previously been explored, of course. But the geology and shape of Aircoth, the contact binary nature of it, and the clear evidence of a gentle merger between the two lobes points very strongly towards one of the competing theories of planetesimal formation, how the seeds of planets are formed, and pretty clearly rejects the main rival theory. The theory that seems to work is called streaming instabilities, or sometimes it's called pebble cloud collapse. It had been battling in the computers of planetary scientists making models with an older theory called hierarchical accretion, and we couldn't really settle it with just theoretical modeling. It really took data, and Aircoth is pretty clearly putting a nail in the coffin of hierarchical accretion, at least at this size scale in the Kuiper Belt, but possibly across the entirety of the solar system. We'll see with future missions.
So if we know how planetesimals get their start, we know how planets get their start?
Well, that's exactly right, because the planets come from the planetesimals. They're built up from the nebula to small bodies like Aircoth, to much larger scales like Pluto and Earth and the other planets.
I had to dig out my old 3D glasses, the red and blue kind, so that I can enjoy some of the images, these 3D images of Aircoth, which are pretty spectacular. Can you talk about this? And was this also something that you did in collaboration with that astrophysicist who used to be in a rock band?
You mean Brian May?
Yeah.
I think if Brian were on the show, he'd be telling me he's still in a rock band.
That's, of course, Queen is still active, isn't it? And in fact, there was that great song about New Horizons that he premiered for us at your celebration.
That's right. He actually wrote his first original piece of music since the late 90s in honor of the flyby of Aircoth by New Horizons. And it just blew us away. And it's a fantastic song. It's an ode to exploration. And Brian isn't just a hanger-on. He's embedded in our science team. It has been now ever since the Pluto flyby. He's on our geology and geophysics team, and he's one of our two experts for doing 3D topographic reconstruction, not just for Aircoth, but Pluto and Charon and the other satellites. He's been on scientific papers. He's produced his own results from that, and also worked by Paul Schenck, another co-investigator on New Horizons down at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. We've learned that Aircoth is quite exotically shaped as a what looked at first like a snowman, but it's an unusual snowman in that once we got to 3D, we could see that the belly and the head are both very flattened, which was a who ordered that moment scientifically, but which ultimately came back to supporting this theory of streaming instability, pebble cloud collapse. It may be very common among the planetesimals of the Kuiper Belt. When we just pulled one out of a bag and this is what we got, what happens, you have to assume that you pulled a typical one out of the bag. And, you know, I'm reminded when Galileo, the spacecraft, was on its way to Jupiter, it made the first flyby of an asteroid. The headline was, the asteroid had a satellite. And up till then, no asteroids with satellites were known. It turns out it was completely typical. Now we know hundreds, if not thousands, of asteroids that have satellites, and we know that they're common. And so I think it's a pretty good bet that what we learned at Aircoth was typical of things in this region of the Kuiper Belt as a minimum, and maybe much more so across the solar system.
I hope that our listeners will check out some of the links relevant to the New Horizons mission and to you that we'll put on this week's episode page at planetary.org/radio. We'll have to put a link to Brian May's song, New Horizons, there as well. I also have to say, before we go further into the solar system, he was just delightful. He was just he had a wonderful press conference while he was there, and he just seemed to be having so much fun. And you're right, when he premiered that song, played it for all of us in that big room at APL, it was the perfect ending for that evening.
Well, I'll tell you, he said something very funny to me the day after the song came out. I asked him, I said, how's it doing? He said, you know, in England, it's number 4 on the charts. He said, but it's not going to go any higher because Bohemian Rhapsody is number 3.
Oh, he beat himself. Well, not bad. Not bad, though. Let's finish this consideration, at least of New Horizons, with, I don't know if it's your most recent major announcement, but it sure blew me away when I once again got out the 3D glasses and took a look at what New Horizons is seeing from not the Kuiper Belt, but from much farther out. Stars that are still amazingly far away, but the closest, among the closest to our own solar system. Tell us about this parallax imaging that New Horizons has enabled, as has never been enabled before.
I'd be happy to. Thanks for asking. It's a really cool experiment, and the credit for it goes to one of our team members, Todd Lauer, from Tucson, Arizona. He's actually a galactic astrophysicist, but he's one of the world's premier image processing experts, and we put him on this mission to help us get the most out of the imagery of Pluto and its satellites and Arrokoth and so forth, because he really is at the very state of the art. And Todd had the realization that New Horizons could photograph the nearest stars and see them in different positions than we see them from the Earth because of our great distance now out in the Kuiper Belt. You know, it's the same idea as if you extend your arm in front of yourself and put a finger up and then switch between your left and right eye, you'll see your finger jump back and forth. Well, because New Horizons is 5 billion plus miles away, the stars, the nearest stars at least, jump back and forth a little bit too. They're in different positions if you photograph them from New Horizons and from the Earth. And that's what we did in April. We had ground-based observatories and amateurs who were photographing these nearest stars from the Earth on the same days that we did it from the Kuiper Belt. And when you combine those images, then you can see those nearest stars, the two that we photographed are Proxima Centauri, the very nearest star, and Wolf 359, which is another of the closest stars, pop out of the image in 3D because of our great distance, allowing us to see them this way. In effect, New Horizons is seeing an alien sky that, and allowing us to see it. We also use that data to perform the world's first interstellar navigation experiment, where without the need of the deep space network and all their tremendous tracking capabilities, we could, from just those images and the images made on the Earth, calculate the position of New Horizons pretty accurately, as if we were on a starship having to do it for ourselves en route to one of those stars. It's been a very nice result, and I think it's going to be something that's in a lot of textbooks. There are very few things the Voyager team didn't do first, but this is one. They probably could have, but once they turned their cameras off, they weren't able to do any more imaging. Because Todd Lauer thought of it, we were the first to carry it out, and we're very happy and proud to be able to do that.
As you should be. It is absolutely striking to put on those 3D glasses and look at Proxima Centauri and Wolf 359, which is, what, about 7.9 light years away, and see how they jump out of the star field that surrounds them because they're so much closer. It is a true three-dimensional view of our stellar neighborhood, at least this limited portion of it. Absolutely fascinating, Alan.
Yeah, absolutely. And your listeners can Google that New Horizons parallax experiment and find those images and the press release about them, or just go to our website, which you said you would link on the page, and navigate to it that way. If they haven't seen it, I hope they'll take a look because it really is something unique and special.
We definitely will include those links at planetary.org/radio. Obviously, all of us congratulate you on the great success, you and the entire team, of New Horizons and its ongoing exploration out there, getting close to the edge of our solar system and looking far beyond it.
Thanks, Matt, for having me and for helping recognize and celebrate the 5th anniversary of the first exploration of Pluto.
That's Alan Stern, planetary scientist, space program executive, consultant, and author. He's the Associate Vice President and Special Assistant to the President at SWRI, the Southwest Research Institute. Chasing New Horizons, that was his 2018 book written with David Grinspoon. The American Astronautical Society gave him its Carl Sagan Memorial Award, and he's been named to the Time Magazine Most Influential 100 list twice. Back with Bruce and that comet in about a minute.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Time for an abbreviated version of What's Up with the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. That would be Bruce Betts. Abbreviated only because, Bruce, as you know, we're not going to be answering the most recent question, well, the second to most recent question, until next week when we answer the most recent question. But I'm so confused.
Yeah, well, I didn't do it. And by the way, as longtime listeners know, I don't think we've ever abbreviated anything significantly in our history.
But. There's no abbreviating the universe, so lay it on us.
No. Oh, what a segue. Well played, sir. Well played. All right, we've got in the evening sky the Jupiter-Saturn combination. Boy, it was just lovely looking at those the other night, being outside. They're coming up not too long after sunset over in the east. Jupiter looking really, really bright as it does. Saturn looking yellowish to Jupiter's left. You'll find them over in the east in the mid-evening, I'd say. And then coming up a couple hours later, Mars also looking bright. Getting brighter through October. It's all quite lovely, forming a line. In the pre-dawn east, we've got Venus, super bright, getting higher. Can't miss it over in the east. And Aldebaran, the brightest star in Taurus, is snuggling up next to Venus, particularly close on the 11th and 12th of July. And then the moon joins in on the 16th and 17th. And then Mercury, not to be outdone, tries to struggle up as high as it can through the rest of the month over in the east, far to the lower left of Venus. But wait, don't worry yet. This is why we can't do an abbreviated thing, because comets happen. And we've got Comet Neowise, discovered by the Neowise spacecraft asteroid program, discovered a comet, and it is visible in the pre-dawn east right now. It is theoretically visible as a naked eye object, but you're going to have real trouble, I would say, unless you're at a pretty dark site, but you might see it. My suggestion, as always with comets, is to try binoculars. Get a finder chart online, go looking with binoculars, and then you can probably see it, depending on how dark your site is with the eyes. And it's doing a tricky little thing. So it's in the pre-dawn east for the next few days, but it's getting lower and lower, so it will actually disappear from the pre-dawn. But wait, once again, don't order yet, because it's coming back in the evening, just after sunset, after its dance with the sun, and will be coming up as few as 5 or 6 days later, so by the 20th, and then it'll be moving across the northern sky. We'll give you more updates. It's a comet. I've been burned by comets many a time, but sometimes they work out. So go check it out. It may be really bright. It may break up and disintegrate. It may hit Matt's house. We'll see. All right, just kidding. Not going to hit Matt's house. We know that.
But it would be just because of my complaint to the solar system about how stingy the Kuiper Belt is with these objects, these dirty snowballs. I'm not going to get my hopes up. If you have binoculars and if you are in a pretty dark place, under a pretty dark sky, you don't have to be in a really dark place. Right. Would you have a chance with binoculars of seeing the tail?
Yes, definitely. All right, on to this week in space history. Two very significant flybys in space history. One, 55 years ago in 1965, Mariner 4 became the first spacecraft to successfully fly by and image Mars. And then in 2015, you may remember, New Horizons did its flyby of the Pluto system 5 years ago.
They might remember that, since we just have been talking with Alan Stern about it. So,
well, but that's why I was wondering.
Nice of you to remind them, though. I'm reading a terrific book, and we'll probably talk more about this on the show, called The Sirens of Mars, and read this great chapter about Mariner 4. That's just a preview. I'll have more to say about that.
I look forward to it. We move on to Space Fact! On average, Venus reflects about 77% of incoming electromagnetic radiation. In other words, light at all wavelengths. 77% gets reflected. For comparison, for Earth, this number, although it varies, is about 31%.
Ooh.
So not nearly as much reflected away. This fraction of incoming electromagnetic radiation at all wavelengths and angles is known in at least planetary circles as the Bond albedo.
Oh.
There you go. There's your little education for the day.
That's great. So it's a mirror planet.
All right, let's move on, shall we?
We could move on. We have a new contest, but we don't have one for you to answer this week. But I thought I would give people at least a little tease because of your question about, remember you asked people to come up with a joke based on light sail.
I did indeed, and I'm looking forward to them.
So here is just a sample. Here is the aforementioned tease, and this is from Stephen Trollinger. Where does the light sail sleep when visiting, Bruce?
I don't know. Where does it?
On the photon.
Oh my God, that's actually funny. Well played.
Stephen says, Stephen adds to that, I'll see myself out. All right. Many more jokes next week. What have you got as a new competition?
Well, following along, here's your question. Who is the Bond albedo named after? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Shaken, not stirred?
Maybe. We'll see.
I thought it was so ridiculous that I figured it was safe to say that, but I will say no more. You have until the 15th. You have until July 15th, that would be Wednesday, at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer for this one and win yourself a Planetary Radio t-shirt. How's that? From Chop Shop Store. Thechopshopstore.com. That's where the Planetary Society store is. You can check out all our merch.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about your favorite Bond planet. Thank you, and good night.
No, Mr. Betts. I want you to die. Well, it's actually Dr. Betts, because he's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its ever-questing members. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Stay well, Ad Astra.